Live your passion and purpose today. This is I Can See Clearly Now with Dr. Wayne Dyer.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. Welcome to today's show. I'm Diane Ray here in the Hay House Mothership Studios in Carlsbad, and I'm so happy to say Dr. Wayne Dyer is here in the studio with me, live for the second week in a row.
You look so beautiful.
It's exciting. Thank you. It's nice to see your face here in person. So I'm excited about the show today. The phone lines are just opening up here, so if you'd like to get in touch with Dr. Dyer, now is definitely your chance because he is a busy guy. He's heading out on an Australian tour, so I know all of our Australian listeners are happy about this. Brisbane, August 15th and 16th, and Melbourne, the 22nd and 23rd, and then heading over to Auckland, New Zealand on August 27th. So you're a very busy guy. So we will have some replays and best of shows in the meantime to kind of tide us over. And then, of course, I Can Do It Orlando in September. So, wow, just
and then London,
busy schedule.
And then off to Israel. It's a world tour. This is my year of traveling.
Yeah. The Wayne Dyer World Tour.
Right.
Well, yeah, I told you earlier we had some people contact me via email in New Zealand. They're very excited to see you because it's been quite a number of years since you've been over there. So
it has. I was there 20-some years ago with Marianne Williamson and John Gray and myself and one of my daughters. Yeah, we had a wonderful time.
It's going to be amazing to visit them again.
I love the Kiwis. I love the Kiwis.
The Kiwis. Now, is that the bird? It's a Kiwi bird, right?
It is. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a bird that doesn't fly. I'm not sure about that, but I.
Well, they're very excited.
Yeah.
So I know.
And I fly tonight, by the way. I mean, in a few hours, I'm getting on a plane and heading. You know, we got a 14-hour flight tonight. So.
That's a long flight.
Yeah,
brutal.
Right.
But you don't eat that airplane food, right?
I do, but sometimes. I just kind of pick at it, you know. a lot of the stuff I don't, you know.
We're lucky we get food, right? Anymore?
I've changed my diet around completely in the last 6 months or so. I'm doing, I'm really cleansing and working at something called radical well-being, trying to get myself in the absolute best shape internally, physically and emotionally and spiritually. So I'm on a program myself, and I drink like 64 ounces a day of fresh squeezed juices, vegetable juices, and so on. I do green smoothies. I cut out sugar completely from my diet.
Wow. Now, do you keep a vegan lifestyle or vegetarian?
No, it's nothing like that. It's just I try to keep the toxins out, the poisons out. I don't eat red meat. Occasionally, I'll eat some chicken, mostly vegetables and so on. But it's the juicing and it's the being wheat-free and gluten-free and also being sugar-free and doing my coffee enemas. I got to do my coffee enemas every day. Yes. Starbucks, that's my new group. and exercising and doing a lot of very deep meditation and really working very hard. It was. I'm staying out here in La Costa for a week, and I was with Deepak Chopra on Friday night. We had a little conversation together, and he introduced me to someone named Rupert Spira, who has written a book called about the transcendence of things, the transparency of things, rather. And I've been listening to some of his work. He's from England, and just it's amazing because at age 75, I have more energy and more excitement and more learning taking place now. I've read some of the really deep Far Eastern, Middle Eastern spiritual texts. I've been reading a lot of poetry. And I think what I'm in a state of preparation for writing something about, because these seminars that I'm doing are called I Am Light. And it's about finding that light within ourselves and recognizing our own infinite nature. And that's been an exciting time for me. And the other day, or maybe a couple of weeks ago, I was watching Jimmy Fallon on The Tonight Show. I don't know if you ever watched Jimmy.
He's hilarious.
He's more than hilarious. He's so immensely talented. He's one of the few people can actually – I don't think there's ever a show that I don't really smile a lot and laugh out loud at some of the antics and watching his ability to to do impersonations. He does just about anybody and dancing and singing and acting and, you know. And so anyway, he came on and he had a very bad accident at home. He fell And he was wearing a wedding ring on his left hand, and that ring caught on as he fell. It caught on the edge of a table, and almost tore his finger off. I mean, his finger was instead of pointing straight up, was pointing directly to the left. He looked at his finger, and it's like it had almost broken off. And so they rushed him to the hospital, and he had to go to a very special place because there's only a few specialists in the world who do this kind of work, this microsurgery, where they have to take every single little stitch, and it has to be done, you know, with this real great precision. And he happened to get the guy who does this, and he was in intensive care for 5 days. And now he's got this bandage on his finger, and it's healing, and eventually his finger is going to be saved. It's going to take almost a year.
What a crazy accident. Crazy just such a
accident.
Random thing.
Absolutely,
like that.
Absolutely, yeah. So, and he almost lost his finger, and he said the doctor who did it said that most people do lose their finger when they have this. So get those wedding rings off.
Right. And I'm looking down. Oh, I'm going to take this off.
So and then he came back a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago now, and he started explaining what had happened with the accident and that he was in surgery and that he was, you know, tied up in intensive care for 5 days. And he showed a book that he read, one of the books that he read. And the book is called Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. Now, this is a book that I required all of my students to read when I was teaching both in high school and when I taught at in college and when I also taught in graduate school. It was required reading. Everybody knew that if they took a course from Dr. Dyer, they would have to read Man's Search for Meaning. It was written by a man named Viktor Frankl, who in 1942, when I was 2 years old, was taken out of his home in Vienna. And along with his wife, who was pregnant at the time, he was in his 20s. He was a psychiatrist, and they took everything away from him. He was Jewish, and he was sent to Auschwitz. He was in Auschwitz for 3 years, and then he went to Dachau in Bavaria near Munich. These are places that I have been to. I've really looked at that because it just man's inhumanity to man has always been one of my greatest mysteries. You know, how can we possibly, when we come from such a place of divine love, turn our thoughts and our awareness into so much hatred and wanting to destroy each other and killing each other and judging each other and putting people into compartments and putting people into ovens and you know, this took place in my life. I mean, you'd think it was the Middle Ages, what was taking place, you know, when millions and millions of people were just being exterminated every day just because of their beliefs, because of their religion, or anything else. So anyway, so he was placed into a concentration camp in Poland. And of every 28 people who went into Auschwitz, one would survive. So 27, your odds were 1 in 28 that you would come out of there alive. And he was one of the ones that did. And he talks about why he did. And then he was liberated in 1945 when I was 5 years of age. Again, it's still impossible for me to even conceive that this was all
it's
taking
still in our
place
lifetime.
When I was a little boy living in an orphanage in Michigan that people were being gassed to death and so on. I still can't even comprehend that kind of thing. I have difficulty even with people having road rage or yelling at other people. I mean, I'd like to consider myself a being of love and have no judgment towards anyone. So in 1978, I had written several best-selling books, Your Erroneous Owns, Pulling Your Own Strings. And because of that, I was invited to Vienna by YPO, the Young Presidents Organization. And I was placed on a panel with two other people, Virginia Satir. I've talked about this on this show before, who is a very prominent conjoint family therapist, brilliant woman, and then also Viktor Frankl. And so the three of us made a presentation, and I was in such awe. By this time, I had been teaching at the university for 6 years, 7 years, and I had also been out of teaching and writing books and lecturing and appearing on The Tonight Show all the time with Johnny Carson and so on. It was just a regular part of my life. And because of the popularity of my books, and they had been translated into so many languages, including German, which he spoke, the title of Your Erroneous Owns in German is called Der Wunderpunkt, which means Your Wondrous Points. So when I was told that I was going to be on a panel with Viktor Frankl, I almost collapsed. I mean, I was just so thrilled and humble at the idea of this to me was one of the great men of the 20th century, and there I was, you know, considered an equal with him, which I didn't think of myself at all. And so I had read Man's Search for Meaning way back there in the 60s and 70s, and I hadn't read it since. That's like now 35, 40
years. And how old was he at this time?
He was born in 1905, so 1978. He was 73. He died in 1997 at the age of 92. And he was lecturing all over the world and just one of the sweetest, kindest, most beautiful men that I'd ever encountered. We went to lunch after my presentation, and I was stammering through my presentation because I just couldn't believe that. And Viktor Frankl
had— You were there talking to him.
Well, he had actually read my book in German and was talking about it. I was just like, you know, I was just so honored. And so after lunch, we went— after the presentation, we went to lunch together, and I remember him saying to me, he said, Wayne, he said, when we are confronted with a situation over which we have no control, he said, we are challenged to change ourselves. And he said, the problem is that most people cannot change themselves because they're so caught up in their beliefs about what is real and what isn't real and what is true and what isn't true. And this is my perceptions of reality. And he gave an example in the talk. He said that we were given a bowl of dirty water and a floating dead fish head floating in it. He said that was our protein for the day. And he said we were challenged to not only not judge that and not only not be angry about it, but to find beauty in it. To be able to find beauty, to be able to see beauty everywhere, even in the suffering that was taking place. And the immense amount of suffering that took place, the people, that the beatings that he took, the frostbitten feet that he, you know, had to work out and from early morning until night. He was a prisoner who was put on work details. He was a medical doctor. He didn't know it at the time, but his entire family, except for one sister who emigrated to Australia, all of them, his wife, she was, the first day that she was taken, she was gassed to death, his mother and his father. And the only reason that he stayed in Vienna, because he knew what was coming, was because of his elderly parents. He just said that he had to stay there and be with them. Even though they had asked him to leave, he said he couldn't. And the kinds of things that he did and so on. And so when Jimmy Fallon held up this book, which I'm holding in my hand right now, I thought, you know what, I've got to reread that. It really touched me in such a deep way. And so I bought it and read it on the plane, and this past week I've studied it again. And there's one sentence in there, one little part of the paragraph that I wanted to just share with you, because so many people talk about their suffering. Now, the kind of suffering— it's hard to even imagine the kind of suffering. Imagine your home. You're in your home today, and you get there, and there's a bunch of Gestapo and Nazis there, and they just—
Right, with guns and yeah, pulling and, you out of your house.
And they just take you away, and everything that you ever owned or that you ever— is just gone, is given, you know, taken away and, you know, is given to somebody else. And you're put on a train with thousands of other people, and on this train you would be sent away to a concentration camp and— you know, at the sign at the door or at the gate of Auschwitz said, abandon hope, all you who enter here. You know, it's like there's no hope for you. You know, you are a prisoner. You are the lowest form of humanity. You will die here. And you will be put to work until you can't walk anymore, and then you will die. And he took notes on this throughout his entire time. So when we talk about suffering, you know, it's and for him to do this for 3 years in bitter cold— until he was finally liberated, and he was a skeleton when he was liberated, and so were so many others. And this is what it says, this one little sentence is, he said, if there is meaning in life at all, then there must be meaning in suffering. Suffering is an ineradicable part of life, even as fate and death. Without suffering and death, human life cannot be complete. And he makes the case in this book, in Man's Search for Meaning, that any suffering that we go through, whatever it might be, emotional suffering, physical suffering, the pain of illnesses, the pain of loss, you know, relationships that that break up and so on, that it's an opportunity. He said there's basically three ways to find meaning in life. One is through your work for whatever it is that you come here to do, and you can feel meaning. Another is in love. In relationships and so on, you can find meaning in being able to love as God loves us because we come from love. And he said the third way is in suffering. And I think back of in my own lifetime of any suffering that I've done in my life, which is in the overcoming of having to live in an orphanage and having been abandoned as a child, the struggle of overcoming addictions earlier in my life, struggle or the suffering involved in a breakup when my wife and I separated 16 years ago. And out of every single one of them, as I began to examine my own life, out of every single one of them, I found very powerful meaning. It was in 2001 or so that I was in just a deep state of sadness and almost depression. And it was out of that state of when my wife and I separated and all that, and my wife and I are very close to this day. We're not living together, but we're very close. She's going on the cruise with us when we go to Israel, and we speak almost every day, and we love each other very much. But at that time, I was forced to look at myself and to see out of this suffering, what meaning can I find in this suffering? And that's when I wrote The Power of Intention, which is some people
that's
think
one of my favorites.
Yeah, some people think of it as I went back and reread The Power of Intention when I was writing I Can See Clearly Now, when I looked through the different phases and what was going on. And I just couldn't believe how good it was. I couldn't believe that I could have written that I could have put that kind of energy and time and that I found all of that information. I was just...
But you couldn't have had you not gone through went through.
Yeah, it was because when you get into this, I mean, one of the things Viktor Frankl talks about is compassion and how suffering brings you to a state of compassion. He says, not for everyone. He said, everyone reacts a little bit different to the suffering. So that some people in the suffering became the lowest form of who they were would come out. And they would steal somebody else's bread, and there were other people who would find meaning in it and share their bread with someone who was who would give their shoes away to someone who was had frostbitten feet and so on, so that for some people suffering meant one thing, and for some others it just meant giving up and not finding it. And the idea he quotes Dostoevsky, the great Russian writer, and Dostoevsky says. He said, I always had to ask the question, am I worthy of my suffering? Am I worthy of it? And I think I asked myself that very same question in my life when I was going through some of the things that are so minor compared to what some people have had to put up with in their life, like Dr. Frankl. And then on page 153, I said, I've got to read this on my radio show. Whenever I do this, I want to share these things with my reader because I wrote next to it in the margin.
It says, wow.
It says, wow. Yeah.
On the page.
And this is what I want to share with you, and then we'll open up the phones. Sigmund Freud once asserted, let one attempt to expose a number of the most diverse people uniformly to hunger. And hunger is such a part of this book, being without food, because they would just get a gram or two of food and they had to, oftentimes just scrounge around for just a few crumbs and so on. So let one attempt to expose a number of this most diverse people uniformly to hunger. With the increase of the imperative urge of hunger, all individual differences will blur. And in their stead will appear the uniform expression of the one unsettled urge. So that's Freud's idea, that all individual differences will melt away when we're confronted with a basic need of hunger. It's like, and we'll all just, be consumed with our need for that. And Viktor Frankl says, thank heaven Sigmund Freud was spared knowing the concentration camps from the inside. His subjects lay on a couch, designed in the plush style of Victorian culture, not in the filth of Auschwitz. There, the individual differences did not blur, but on the contrary, people became more different. People unmasked themselves, both the swine and the saints. And today, you need no longer hesitate to use the word saints. Think of Father Maximilian Kolbe, who was starved and finally murdered by an injection of carbolic acid at Auschwitz, and who in 1983 was canonized. That just because you're faced with like the most horrible conditions that a human being can be faced with, you can become worthy of your suffering. And some people did, and you know, even went into the gas chambers, you know, with a prayer on their lips, finding meaning even in that kind of thing. So as you think about your calls to me and and about your life and about the suffering that that you experience, ask yourself the question that Fyodor Dostoevsky asked himself. Am I worthy of my suffering? Is this one of the opportunities for me to find meaning in my life? And it doesn't have to be something where I just give up on myself and become what he called swine. You can become a saint as well in the midst of your suffering. And I like to think that the suffering that I've experienced in my own life, the separations, the anxieties, the stress, the fears, have really helped me to become a better person, to find more meaning in my life. And some of the best things I've done, some of the best talks I've ever given, were when I was suffering inside and struggling and was able to just develop a kind of compassion for others.
And pull something beautiful right. out of that.
Yeah.
Such an amazing lesson yeah. and such a strong message.
So I just urge you all. I used to tell my students, and I often say in my lectures, man's search for meaning is and this book's got some additional essays in the back, but you can read the book in about 2 hours. It's really not that long. And it was written shortly after he was liberated. And it's hard for you not to ask yourself the question, how would I have done? How would I have done? Would I have survived that?
I wonder. I don't know. I like to think I'm good in a crisis.
Yeah.
But again, presented with something like that that is really unimaginable, I wonder how I do. But right. I think it's interesting what you said, too, about how the true nature would come out where some people would be more compassionate
right.
and as a result be more resilient than the ones that...
Well, I think of Gandhi, yeah. I think of Martin Luther King, despite the beatings, despite the starvation, despite, all of the things that were being done, they found, Gandhi found a way to rally his people to overcome the entire British Empire. Martin Luther King, if you've seen Selma, have you seen the film Selma?
It's a very powerful
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, I was almost there. I was on my way to go down there, 50 years ago when that took place. But it's, I didn't. But I was doing a lot of other things. But he still found a way to find meaning in to use nonviolence rather than to take on the same kind of actions and repay the violence that was being visited on them in the same way. That we have to be better than that.
Mm-hmm.
Think of Jesus, on a cross, being being tortured. And a soldier throws a spear into him, and his response is, forgive them, Father, for they don't know what they do. I think he meant they don't know that when they throw a spear into me, they're throwing a spear into all of humanity because we're all one. So,
right.
Think about your own sufferings as you ask
your questions. Well, I've got nothing
today.
To complain about at this
yes,
point.
Yes, exactly. Anyway, I wanted to share that. I'm glad I did that today.
No, I'm so glad you
yeah.
did. It's such an amazing book. Mm. So let's grab some calls while we still have some time on the show. And
okay.
since you are going to Australia, let's start in Melbourne.
Oh, good. I'm coming there next week.
And here's Kathy on line two.
Ah!
Hi, Kathy.
Hey, hello. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. How are you, my dear?
I'm fantastic. This is so exciting. I can't believe I'm the first caller.
So what's going on down there in Melbourne? It's August, and they tell me it's winter. I think you guys got things mixed up. Are you in the wrong hemisphere, or am I doing something?
Well, you know what? I'm actually from Canada originally, but I married my husband, and I have two small children. So now I'm in Australia.
Oh.
So it's not it's not like Canadian winter, but it's still cool.
Yeah,
it's definitely your sweater.
Oh, I've been there. I've been there many times. I love Melbourne. That was another place you talk about suffering. The last time I spoke in Melbourne about 3 years ago, I collapsed on stage. I had never ever had an experience like that. My neck was just something went off in my neck. I've healed that now, but at that time, I was in a very bad way. But I also went back out on stage about an hour later and was able to finish it. Yeah, so what's on your mind today, my dear?
Well, you know, it's so funny. I had something on my mind, and now after listening to your talk,
I thought to myself, nobody's ever going to call the show again because, you know, you can't. Do you know about Viktor Frankl? Have you read Man's Search for Meaning?
I haven't, but now I have it written down. Mm. I've heard you speak about him before, and I definitely want to read that book now. It's pretty incredible, and it does make my first world small problems seem pretty small, given the magnitude of the life and the experience that he's had, and you know, and a lot of the other people that you've mentioned as you've been talking. Mm. And, you know, just before your show came on, I was on Facebook, and I saw this clip of a little boy in Savannah, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was, I think, 4 years old, he lost his father.
Mm-hmm.
And then a year later, he lost his mother.
Mm-hmm.
And so at one point, he realized that he noticed that people weren't smiling around him. And so he said to his carer, who's his aunt, he said, "I just want to bring the smiles back to everyone." And so that's when it started. And then he goes onto the streets of Savannah and he gives people who aren't smiling toys.
Mm.
So that he, even though he's in his, you know, his young life, he has endured immense suffering, I can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
He still has this light inside of him that he's so clear about, and he just wants to bring joy to people. Mm. It's so beautiful.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. You know, I was also in Australia the day that Mother Teresa died. It was way back, I think 2001, if I'm not mistaken, right in that area. And, you know, she often said that, you know, every day, she said, every day I see Jesus Christ in all of his distressing disguises. In other words, you know, whatever poverty that she would encounter, whatever suffering that she would see going on in people, she would see God. She would see the Christ in each and every one of them. And that's what allowed her to live the kind of life that she lived. And I remember I was speaking in Darling Harbour in Sydney that morning. And I was going on, it was about 9 o'clock in the morning. And 5 minutes before I went to speak, someone came up and told me that Mother Teresa had passed, and I had been honored to be in the presence of Mother Teresa and an interview in Phoenix, Arizona, back in the 1980s. And and I said to the audience that I just announced that Mother Teresa had just passed, and I said, "Isn't it just like her?" I said, "She left when the whole world's attention was on the funeral of Princess Diana." And you know, and I said, wouldn't it be just like her to, with no ego whatsoever, to say, I'm just going to sort of sneak out now so that nobody even notices and put all of the attention on, you know, on what was taking place in that the day of her funeral. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, that's interesting. That was actually 1997. And the only reason I know that is because I moved to London 3 weeks after that she died.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember looking at Kensington Palace, and even though it was 3 weeks later, the flowers were still...
Right.
You could see them for miles, and I just remember thinking, as I sat there, some people had actually brought pictures of Mother Teresa as well to put in with the flowers. So I thought, oh, that's beautiful. At least there's a recognition that someone else really amazing has left our world too.
Right. Yeah. Well, what were you calling for, even though it may seem trivial at this point? But tell me what motivated you to pick up the phone today. You're such a lovely lady. Okay. Are you going to be there in Melbourne? I'm speaking with Anita Moorjani the 22nd. I think it's the 22nd and 23rd, Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So at this point, money is very tight, but I'm not counting it out yet. I'm going to reassess it in the week before you get, which is next week. Mm-hmm.
So here's what we're going to do. You're going to come as my guest. Okay, you're going to come as my guest. You leave your name. You come to the door that day, and you ask for either Maya or Leon, and you tell them that I invited you to be on the show, or I invited you to come to the seminar as my guest, just because you picked
amazing.
Up the phone today. So money is no longer an issue. Now you have no excuses. Yeah, you come in and ask for Maya Labos. She works for me, and she'll know because I'll tell her on the plane tonight that we're heading to Brisbane tonight. And then the following Saturday and Sunday I'll be there. And you can bring a guest as well. So if you'd like to bring your husband.
My husband will be working, or he'll have to take care of our children.
Oh, okay.
But I do have enough that I'd love to go. I have to repay you in some way, and I took the writer's workshop via live stream.
Oh, did you?
I did.
From Maui?
Maui, yeah. Well, yeah. I wasn't there. I was
via
live stream. I woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning, so I was there with your spirit. But I noticed you really like to have a green smoothie. So if I could make you and Maya a green smoothie for the morning, that would really make my whole weekend.
you bring me a green smoothie. It's Kathy, right, from Melbourne? What's your last name?
K-O-M-A-N.
K-O-M-A-N, Coleman?
And we'll get your information, Kathy, so don't hang up, okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we'll see that you have a place right in the front row, right there with me. All right, God bless you.
We're kind of losing our connection
there,
but
thanks
hold
for your
on.
Call.
We'll hook her up. We got connections for this
we
one.
Got, that's right. Absolutely. I'll tell Leon. If you won't let her in, I'm not coming.
That's it. So let's go after that one to Zephyr Hills, Florida, and Amanda. And she is on line one. Thanks for calling in, Amanda.
Hi. I can't believe this. I just put it right into my imagination. And just like Dr. Dyer always says, since the second I heard your voice, Dr. Dyer, it's been a dream of mine. To speak to you. I'm almost in tears right now.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you so much. You've gotten me through some very strenuous times in my life, and I humbly appreciate you. You are truly, truly not of this earth, sir.
None of us are.
That's right. So anyway, that's so strange because Mother Teresa's If You Can't Feed 100 People, Feed Just One is on the back of my business card right
wow.
now.
Mm-hmm.
I work for a foundation that feeds hungry children in the community. And so my question is, we're just a little foundation. We started about 150 bags a week. We feed kids on the weekends when they don't have their school food. There's a high volume of food insecurity in our area. So we started about 150 bags a week, and we're to well over 1,000 now of kids in our area that we pack the bags and take them to the schools so the kids have something to eat, you know, when they go home. And my question to you is how do you handle when people that you love very much and are close in your life with you maybe don't feel like you're on the same paths, not that they aren't supporting you? But you super want them to be excited with you. Like I put this into my consciousness that I said, God, please put me somewhere my love matters.
Mm.
I have too much love. And, you know, so not that they maybe don't support and think you're on a good path, but you want them to just bandwagon along with you. And that doesn't necessarily happen.
No, it doesn't. It hardly ever does.
Yeah.
You know, basically, here's what you're saying, Amanda. If only you were more like me, then I wouldn't have to be so upset with you right now.
Yes, that's right.
I do the same thing. I mean, two of my daughters are coming with me to Australia, Skye and Sage, and they'll both actually be on the program. I'm going to have Skye sing, and Sage is going to talk about her book. I gave them each $1,000 yesterday in cash. To come, you know, for spending money for the next, they're going to be with me for the next 2.5 weeks. And both of them, you know, I adore these kids, okay, obviously every one of them. And they took the money and they put it in their wallet. And then they were just continuing on with the conversation. I said, wait a minute. I said, you were just given $1,000, $1,000. I expect jumping up and down. I expect you to be, you know, I can't contain myself in the excitement. It just, the windows just opened and the wind just blew $1,000 into my hand. Where's the excitement? Oh, Dad, well, you know, we're excited. We're happy. But, and it's basically, it reminds me of what your question is. If only you were more like me, is what I'm saying, you know, because if that was my mother, when my mother was alive and I would give my mother, you know, $1,000 for this or to buy her a nice piece of jewelry. Oh, my God. She would jump up and down. She would just say, oh, you can't believe it. She'd call everybody that she knew. She couldn't, you know. And you know what? Everybody's unique. Everybody has their own way. And some people are quiet. I mean, I love, there's a woman that I love very, very, very much in my life. And she doesn't go around saying all the kinds of things that I do. She's not like poetic and maudlin like I am and all of these kind of things. She just like, has a different way of doing it. She always reminds me, just because I'm not like you and just because I don't do, doesn't mean I don't feel it inside the same way. So what I would suggest is that you keep your attention on just the love. And they say the greatest, the greatest way of expressing the God within you is to do something for somebody else with no expectation of even a thank you. You know, it's like that poem I always quote from Hafiz, you know, even after all this time, Hafiz said, the sun never says to the earth, you owe me. Just think what a love like that can do. It lights up the whole world. You know?
That's right. And I'm listening to Mastery of Love right now with a book on tape, and I think it is just brilliant, you know, their thought. You know, I just think that was shared by a friend to me, and, you know, it's just stuff is just manifested into my life so in perfect timing that, you know, it's just, it is amazing. It is, you know, what the Lord's plan for you. Mm. And sometimes it makes you feel like, am I on the right path? By being around people that don't feel the same way as me, but maybe that is part of my path.
That is your path, dear. That is your path. And that's what you have to get at. It doesn't matter how they react. You don't, I often say, you know, when you see someone standing on the side of the road with a piece of a brown paper written on a bag, I'm homeless, you don't have to give them money. You know, you can give a silent blessing. And, but the thing that you don't have to do is give a judgment and say, oh, they should be out working or they should be doing any of those things. They are where they are. And how you treat people is your karma. How you react I'm saying that wrong. How you treat people is your karma, okay? And how people react is theirs. So it's your reaction or how people treat you. That's their karma. But how you react, that's yours. And let go of any judgment that you have about how the world ought to be. It's just exactly the way it's supposed to be. And the people are behaving and reacting exactly as they know how to do. And there's no higher calling than that. There's no higher calling.
And you really do start to feel as your vibrations heighten, you know, that the certain people that I'm speaking of, I see it heightening too. But it's just come along with me, be right where I am. Just like you said, that's not it.
Right. Sometimes you don't even, you know, I remember years ago when I was working on my doctorate and I was doing an apprenticeship and doing some group therapy and so on. And I would notice that, somebody wouldn't speak for the entire time. They wouldn't, or sometimes in speaking before an audience, I will look at the audience out there and I'll see someone who looks like they're either asleep or that they're not interested and so on. And I'll think to myself, you know, why am I paying so much attention to this? And then when the talk is over, very often that person or the person in the group that I was talking about when I was doing an apprenticeship as a doctoral student, I would say to them, you haven't said anything for 8 weeks. You haven't said a word. You never contribute anything. Aren't you getting anything out of it? And I remember this woman saying, oh, my God, this has been the most important thing that I've ever experienced in my life. I'm just not ready to speak about it yet. You know, I'm just not ready yet. Yeah. Anyway, I want to send you a copy of my daughter's beautiful book.
Oh, me and my mom are just trying to save every penny to get. We're real close to Orlando.
Oh, okay.
So, but the Friday night alone is sold out, and so we're going to have to do the whole weekend, and I don't know if we're going to be able to.
No, you'll get in. You'll get in. We'll get you.
So we'll, Well, thank you so much. Yeah. I just have to say I just love you. You are just
such an inspiration.
Much.
Yeah,
thank
we'll get you
so
in on Friday night. Leave your yes, absolutely. We'll get you in again. You let me know, okay, when you get there. I'll get you in. I don't think it's sold out anyway. I think they just say that.
I know that you can still
it's a marketing ploy.
Weekend,
yeah, there's no such thing as a sellout. We'll get you in. You'll be there. Leave your address. I want to send you Don't Die With Your Music Still In You. It's my daughter's wonderful book about being raised around people like me and her mom, which she used to call weird, but now she calls spiritual. So leave your address.
Distinction
okay?
now. No, we'll get you taken care of, Amanda, for Friday.
Yes, absolutely. You're all set. You'll be there.
We'll slide you in.
Okay.
So
God
bless you. So let's go to Heather in Austin, such a great city, Austin, Texas. And she's on line 3. Hi, Heather. Hi. Thanks for joining the show today.
Hi.
Hi, Dr. Dyer. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
How are you two today?
Just
wonderful.
Perfect. It's all perfect. Yeah, getting ready to get on an airplane and fly for 14 hours.
I'll just put in that Wishes Fulfilled meditation CD. That'll help you get across.
You are right.
The big pond.
Thank
That's
you.
That's what I use on planes. I love that one.
I do too. I play it every day. Yeah.
Oh, me too. Me too. And I saw James Twyman here in Austin. I guess it was actually last weekend he was here, and he's quite amazing. What a remarkable musician he is.
He is. He's an amazing man. He really he's had an amazing life. You know, he's had to overcome some very, very difficult things. You know,
This is true.
Yeah, his wife was murdered.
I understand that. Yeah. And this so the whole program has really led to my question for you today. I've studied so much of your work, and I've had so much fun speaking to you before. I'm your gardener friend here in Austin. And so much of what I've learned from you is about our oneness, and you've really been talking about that a lot today. And I will even add one story that I uncovered was Nelson Mandela. When he was in prison, he actually created a garden, a vegetable garden, and that gave him some relief from this horrible situation he was in. And Dr. Dyer, he shared the produce with the guards because he didn't see any separation between himself and even the people imprisoning him.
Yeah. And I know that about him. I went to Robben Island where he was imprisoned and sat outside of his cell and meditated. And he left me a copy of his book autographed. I was one of the great treasures of my life called A Long Walk to Freedom. And, the other thing about Nelson Mandela is that he went into silence. He wasn't even allowed to talk for years and years and years to anyone. And because he was in that deep silence, when he came out of the silence, he had nothing but forgiveness and reconciliation in his heart. It got rid of, because in silence, Melville said that God's one and only voice is silence. That's why meditation is so important. It's such a powerful part of the path, is that you get to that place where there's no division. You get to the place of oneness. And because he spent so much of his time in his life in silence, he was able to take a situation in South Africa, which looked like it was going to be just a bloody, bloody mess down there with the violence that they anticipated, and to do it relatively peacefully because of the time that he had spent in conscious contact with God, I believe, yeah.
So that. All of these amazing teachers, and I will include you, you've been an incredible teacher to me and so many others, have taught this oneness. And then I currently hear a lot of coaches and people talk about boundaries. And so my question for you is, to me, it almost feels like boundaries have lost their meaning to me, this way to protect you from, being hurt by others or taken advantage by others. Or do you feel like boundaries are something that are real and necessary?
I think that the idea of boundaries, we obviously have to, keep ourselves, protected from people just being abusive and so on toward us and in their language. But at our essence, at our very where we all are, where we come from, we're all just individual attributes of God. We all come from the same place, and we all are going to return to the same place. The old thing that T.S. Eliot said, "We shall not cease from exploration." But at the end of all of our exploring will be to return to the place from which we originated and to know it for the first time. And there you the concept of boundary is impossible. The concept of boundary, one of the things we do in meditation is try to rid ourselves of any of the lines or any of the borders or any of the boundaries that that we've created for ourselves. And when we recognize that, if you recognize the most difficult thing that I'm confronting right now and dealing with and writing about and so on is this whole idea of oneness, you know, that, you know, Larry Dossey wrote an entire book about it called One Mind. I've just been introduced to someone through Deepak on Friday night called Rupert Spira, who speaks about non-duality. You know, in our core, in our essence, in the deep silence within each and every one of us, that's where we'll find God. Our egos, the part of us that have taken on this belief, this false belief that who we are is what we accumulate and what we have and separate from other people and what we, you know, we're our bodies and we're the color of our bodies and we're the, you know, the cultural country that our bodies happen to show up in. You know, from a deeper perspective, you begin to see the oneness and our identification with our body and with our accomplishments and with the things that we own and so on is the greatest impediment to our connecting ourselves to God. Once we understand that who we are is connected to everything and everyone in that deepest place and begin to live from that place, boundaries become an artificial thing. But for those who aren't there, boundaries are absolutely necessary in order to keep people from, violating other people. So it's a very good point. It's a very good point indeed.
Well, I think we've talked before, but what I'm writing about and working on is our connection with nature, and that's mm-hmm. been so powerful and meaningful to me. And I think it's easy, it's approachable for a lot of people when you're in nature to sort of lose that sense of
separation. Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
And I think that's a portal to the divine. I think that for many people who might want to draw a line and say, I'm this color, or I'm that religion, or I'm from this country, mm-hmm. or any of these different things, when you stand in front of the ocean, you just experience, you know, or you stand in front of a flower, you don't have a need to name it to have the beauty.
Right. Yeah.
So that's kind of what, and I've been feeling that too. Maybe I'm not so good at the boundary part. Maybe I'm better at the sensing the oneness and everything. And that makes you vulnerable, but, you know, vulnerability is kind of a good thing.
It is. And, you know, basically, Heather, it's the misalignment that we have. We've aligned ourselves with the belief that it's only the things that I can experience with my senses. You know, if I can see it, if I can smell it, if I can touch it. Last night I had a dream, and in the dream, I was standing at the window of where I have a place on Maui, and the water was coming in and it was taking away the beaches, and and with each passing second, more and more water was coming in, and then it came up over the beach, then it came up over the sidewalk, then it came up over the grass, and then the water started coming into through the window. And I was telling the kids in my dream to make sure that get those windows closed so that the water doesn't come in. And all of a sudden, I could feel the water on my coming into the and I could see the color of the sand, and I could see the grass. The color of the grass was green, you know. And I could actually hear the roar of the water as they're coming. Now, there's three sensory things that I was doing. I was seeing, I was hearing, and I was feeling, and yet I didn't have a body, I didn't have any eyes, I didn't have any ears, I had nothing to touch with. All of that was just laying in the bed, and there I was experiencing without what we call sensory feelings, without any sensory apparatus to do it with. The oneness that I'm speaking about is an awareness that even in waking consciousness, because, you know, Thoreau said your goal is to become a waking dreamer, to be able to do everything that you can do in your dream while you're conscious, while you're awake. And we don't need eyes. We don't need ears. We don't need noses. We don't need feelings in order to be able to grasp the essence of what it means to be human. We are so conditioned to believe that in our, you know, it's what I see with my senses. You know, that's that great line from William Blake, you know. We are all led to believe a lie, he said, when we see with, not through the eye, which was born in a night to perish in a night, while the soul slept in beams of light. And that's why I call it I am light. You've got to go to that place within you that is beyond the senses, beyond the feeling, the touching, the smelling, the hearing, and recognize that who we are is capable of experiencing all of that independent of these physical bodies that we're in. And that's the answer to the boundaries issue as well, you know. But listen, I've been on too long. We've just only got a few minutes left, and I want to get to at least one more call. Can I send you a copy of my beautiful daughter's book that we wrote together called Don't Die With Your Music Still In You? Leave your address, and I'll send it.
Okay? We will send that out to you in Texas. And thanks for the call. It was a great question. And let's see if we can get one more in. Let's go all the way down to Queens, New York, and Mike on line 9. And we have just about 4 minutes, but go ahead with your question, Mike.
Hello, Dr. Dyer. How are you?
I'm great, Mike.
Thank you for taking the call. I'll try to be very brief because I know we're at the end of the show. You've always helped me out with a lot of things in my life, and now I've come to a point where I basically grew up in an abusive house. My father hit my mother, you know, cursing, yelling. I'm 36 years old now. I'm married. I've had a child, all that stuff. Most recently, he's come back to that person that we know, he abused her again. You know, we have a lot of problems, and I'm stuck in between anger and feeling. Excuse me, I'm sorry. And feeling sorry for him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm forgive me.
No, I'm with you, my friend.
I'm in between that line. You know, between anger and feeling sorry for him. Because I know that he was also abused, and I try to forgive him, but then sometimes, you know, the rage comes out again because I feel sorry for my mother as well. You know, I'm right in between, so I'm just looking for some type of direction.
Well,
for my emotions.
Because we don't have that much time, but I really want to say that your anger, your judgment, your hostility, your rage, I know about this. I had a father who did the same thing, who abandoned us and walked away, and I never saw him again. And it was only when I went to his grave in 1970, and I was able to send love in response to the hatred that he showed toward me, that everything in my life changed. So I would say, you know, the Chinese have an old proverb that says, if you're going to pursue revenge, you'd better dig two graves.
Yeah.
Because you're gonna need one for yourself as well, because it will kill you, this stuff that you've gone on inside you. Forgiveness, said Mark Twain, forgiveness is the fragrance that the violet sheds on the heel that has crushed it. You've got to become a violet. And no matter what has crushed you, you've got to be able to send love in response to it. It's the ultimate challenge. It's your purpose. It's why you're here. And when you're able to do that, when you're able to just let go and let God and allow who you are, your essence is you came from love. You came from a place of perfect love. Love is what the universe is made out of. Imagine the universe being made out of anything other than love. What would hold it together? It would all be fighting each other. We'd all, you know, everything would just collapse. Love is the very essence of who we are, what our universe is, what our infinite consciousness is. It's just something called love. And we, through the development of these false selves, through this ego that we take on, create a space within us that says, I'm going to send love out. You know, and divine love is the kind of love that you want to have. It's the kind of love that God has for you, that the infinite consciousness has for you. You know, you showed up in this infinite consciousness. You showed up in it. And as a result of being in it, you can either be what it is, which is love, or you can take on the ego, the false self, and begin and fill yourself with the rage. I would recommend that you reach out to this man, and that you send him, you know, the only thing that you want to have inside of you. It's like the proverbial orange. When you squeeze an orange, you get what's inside. When someone squeezes you, you get out of you what's inside. Have love inside, and that's all that will come out. We're going to send you a copy also of my daughter's, my book, Together. Don't Die With Your Music Still In You. Thanks for your calls. Great show today.
And hold on, Mike. Dr. Wayne Dyer will be back in a few weeks with another live radio show, so stay tuned for some best of shows coming up.